Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right.
I have so many thoughts
Molly's
about you
here,
and Gracie.
I'm here. Gonna... Mark's here. Who else do we need?
Is there anything in my teeth? We're good.
Oh, my God. You guys had a mouthful of water. Jesus.
Oh, hello, everyone. It's Molly Wood, and I've done it again.
Oh, man.
Don't you check?
Jesus. Jesus.
Sorry, I made him spit out water. He'll be with us shortly.
That's all
professional
right.
Professional as always here.
Yes. Water coming out of my nose. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back with the Tuesday Big Show edition of our now daily podcast, Make Me Smart. Deep dive into everything tech, the economy, and culture. We are going to take a deep dive today into a thing that is not getting, in my humble opinion, enough press in this entire catastrophe. And that is what is going to happen to state and local budgets as this crisis endures, with no sales tax, all kinds of revenue streams drying up. It's going to be a big, big, big giant problem.
Yes, it is becoming a problem already. I think I read yesterday that California has already borrowed money, became the first state to borrow money from the federal government to pay unemployment. States are already furloughing workers. Louisville, Kentucky furloughed 380 city workers. Los Angeles is asking city workers to take 26 days of unpaid leave. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of like what's happening now. That's only going to get worse.
I was going to say, which is not going to get any better anytime soon. And this is a giant problem, right? So many people in this economy are employed by state governments. They get their money, as I said, from sales and income taxes. It's all going to be a problem. There's rising unemployment. I mean, all of these things are going to pile up and be a big fat punch in the nose for state and local governments. Mark Nicole is on the line. He's the president of the National Association of State Budget Officers, also the deputy secretary of the Department of Budget and Management in the great state of Maryland. Mark, thanks for coming on.
You're very welcome.
So look, let's do a little primer here, right? For those who may not follow it as closely as those of us in the actual field, where do states and municipalities get their money?
Sure. So if you look at state governments, Kai, we get about 41% of our revenues from what we call general funds. So those are generally tax sources, the personal income tax, the sales tax, the corporate income tax, and maybe some other smaller taxes, estate and inheritance, insurance premiums. We get about 30% of our revenue from the federal government. That comes in the form of assistance with Medicaid and other grant programs that the federal government administers and shares with the states. And then we get about 26-27% of our budget from what we call special funds. So those are sort of dedicated source revenues. Might be something like in many states, transportation is a dedicated source revenue. So all our gas tax, our titling tax go into a special fund only to be used for that particular purpose. A lot of states run their park programs as special funds too. And higher education revenues are also considered these special sources of revenue, stuff like tuition and fees. So that's where our state revenues come from.
Right. Gotcha. And so I hope you're not going to say all, but you might. Which of those streams of income are disrupted now as a result of this pandemic?
Well, I would say that on our general fund side, the two largest sources that are being disrupted are the personal income tax, and that makes up about 45% of our general fund revenue. The second source that's being disrupted a lot is our state sales tax. On average, across the country, states get about 20% of their revenue from that. So those are their two largest sources of revenue. They total about two-thirds of all revenue. So those are really being disrupted. And I would say the third that's being disrupted a lot is transportation revenues. People aren't driving. So that's gas tax that states aren't collecting. Vehicle sales have declined very significantly in the last month or so. So that's titling and sales tax revenue not going into transportation coffers.
Can we, and look, I will confess up front that your answer is going to have to be some kind of swag on this one. But Speaker Pelosi a number of weeks ago was talking about trying to get $500 billion for state aid. That's what the National Governors Association has asked for. Is $500 billion, half a trillion dollars, going to fill the hole, you think, that states are facing?
I think the answer is it depends on how long this recession sort of lingers, right? So a big concern that we have, obviously, is unemployment has gone from, you know, under 4% to, I think they're estimating it could be announced around 16% next week. That's not going to go back to 4% right away. So the lingering effects of unemployment will result in reduced revenues for many years. So $500 billion might be enough. Just depends on how long this crisis lasts.
Man.
Well, and that's assuming that help is allocated, right? Which seems to be in some question now.
Correct.
How worried are you that there might not be any aid coming?
I think all the states are worried right now. We are kind of flying blind a little bit. This recession has come upon us very quickly. If we look at sort of the Great Recession, we didn't really know we were in it until we were in it for a few months. Here, we know we're in it, and the magnitude of the revenue losses that we're looking at are larger than what we experienced over a multiple-year period during the Great Recession. There are states out there that have been talking about revising their revenues down, you know, somewhere in the 15 to 20% range. During the Great Recession, states on average had revenue declines of about 12%. So we're seeing a bigger decline in a shorter period.
So when you in the Maryland State Department of Budget and Management have your morning Zoom calls, when you talk things over, what are those conversations like? Is it apocalyptic, or is it we can work this problem?
It's sort of a combination right now. I think we're a little bit worried about the magnitude of the hit and the timing. A couple weeks ago, our state comptroller announced a sort of a worst case scenario for a revenue revision of $2.8 billion over the next 3 months. If the shutdown stayed in place until the end of June. So what that would have meant for us is that roughly our total state revenue collections over the next 3 months would have been down 50% per month. And when we started trying to put that into our budget planning forecasts and using our reserve funds and other tools that we have to get to balance in the budget, we weren't there. So, yes, I mean, we have ideas of how we can get places, but when you're talking about a number you haven't contemplated before, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't even know where to start. Which states will feel it more and why? You know, do states have reserves?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
Sure. So that's a great question. So obviously, different states are going to feel the impact differently. Those states that are very energy dependent right now are probably going to experience this much worse than many other states because their revenue structures are more dependent on oil prices and other mineral prices. But those are states generally that have done a better job setting up reserves. So this is one of the good things that one of the lessons that states learned from the Great Recession was that, you know, we need to do a better job about planning and setting aside revenues. When we went into the Great Recession, overall as states, we had an average of about 4.8% of revenues in reserve. Right now, we're about 8%. So we're not quite double that, but we're a little bit better prepared for this recession. And we have, you know, certainly at many of our national budget officers meetings, we are constantly, this is one of our topics about, you know, being prepared.
Yeah. So look, these numbers, while informative, are abstract, right? Because, you know, if I'm going about my daily life trying to survive quarantine, you know, a bunch of statistics are great, but they're not visceral. So how's this going to manifest
Correct.
in, let's say, my local police department or, you know, the county fire department or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right. So let me sort of put it in context a little bit. And I'll talk to you about kind of in the state context, but in a way, what the state does sometimes flows down to the local government. So when we're looking at our state budgets, you know, what do we spend our money on? We spend about a little more than a third of our budgets on K through 12 education. We spend about 20% of our budget on Medicaid, and then we spend other amounts on public health. So you can really begin right now to see, so, you know, for instance, K through 12, you know, if that's about a third of the budget and you're looking at, you know, if you were just sort of trying to do an allocation sort of across the board, that's a pretty significant effect. And who runs K through 12 education? Local government. So if we're, as states, plan to do less to help K through 12, that puts additional burden on local governments because they share those costs. Our Medicaid program that's providing key health services, right? So we're going into a recession and our unemployment's going to go up. Our welfare rolls are going to go up. More people are going to qualify for Medicaid. So we're going to be seeing increased costs there. And that's really, in most state budgets, that's the second largest line item. So when you've got sizable cuts to make, you have to sort of go where the money is, right? And so the programs that are going to be providing essential sort of health services to folks at the same time may be receiving less money. And, you know, we as state budget officers have to figure out how we're able to do that. And there's, you know, obviously many things that we've done in the past. So when we're looking at healthcare costs, we have a lot of service providers, managed care organizations that run health networks. We pay physicians, hospitals. So oftentimes when states get into difficult times, we pay these providers less. So then that puts strains on how they're able to run their organizations and maybe pay their own staff. Another area, obviously, that we look at as states, we look at our own workforce. So about 20% of our state budgets on average are payroll and salaries and sort of benefit costs. So when we're short in revenues, we're going to be looking at things like implementing furloughs of our state workforces, potentially laying off some employees, doing some pay cuts, making the size of government smaller. So that's going to be an immediate impact. Obviously we're in a situation where we don't want more people unemployed, but it kind of is a somewhat cyclical kind of endeavor for us to save our budgets. We have to hurt other areas.
So what, as we go through this recitation of like, when you need it most, schools, health, and unemployment will not be there. What you, your organization wrote a letter to the president and congressional leadership, you know, saying nicely, thank you for what you've done so far. It was probably not enough. Like, what can be done? Is there something that can be done from the federal government or otherwise to stave off kind of the worst of the list you just gave us?
Right. So yes. And that was really what the letter was about. It was really to say that state and local governments, and they're really in the same boat as states, we need additional assistance. Right now, we don't know the sort of magnitude of the reduction, but we are going to very quickly, because most states have balanced budget requirements, 49 of the 50. The only one that doesn't is Vermont. Yeah. So we have balanced budget requirements. Many of us are 2 months from the end of our fiscal year, and we need to sort of, finish in the black, you know, so we need to get our budget balanced. So if we don't get aid really quickly.
Is that even realistic? You got 2 months to figure this out and the bottom has fallen out. And oh, by the way, you got to balance the budget. Come on, man. Right?
Yeah, doesn't it seem like we could just change that part? Money's free right now, I heard.
Yes.
Debt galore.
Right. Obviously, and we're working over sort of 2 years, right? We are working on... trying to get through the year we're in right now that ends on June 30th. And then we've got another budget that starts on July 1 and goes for the next fiscal year. So we're trying to come up with solutions for two. So right now, without any assistance, we are planning for the worst. It's almost really like the you know, the healthcare practitioners are out dealing with the pandemic. They're and all the emergency management staff, they're preparing for the worst case, and they're hoping for the best. So we are, as budget officers, putting together a very draconian sort of list that we will be providing to our governor. We are in the process of revising our revenue forecasts, because a lot of this is really going to depend on, you know, how those revenues come in. If they come in a little bit better, well, that's great, because that means you don't have to maybe do as much. If we get federal aid, wow, once again, that means we may not have to do as many cuts. I think as budget officers, we realize that we're in a situation where some level of reductions is going to be needed. I think what we are looking for from the federal government is some help to sort of mitigate the worst of the worst, right? We don't want to do things that are going to make the economy worse going forward, and keep what will become an expansion from moving forward as quickly as possible.
Mark DeCole, he's the president of the National Association of State Budget Officers, also the deputy secretary of the Department of Budget and Management in Maryland. Mark, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and your thoughts. This is a tough topic, man. Holy cow.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
It very much is, and I want to thank you for having me on.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Best of luck to you.
Take care.
So, you know, one word, right? Screwed. Screwed.
Oh, I was going for two words. Taxes? Debt? Yeah. No, that's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the man is in the position of making worst case scenario lists.
Yep.
I'm a big fan of the philosophy that nothing is ever as bad or good as you think it's going to be, but... But yes, I mean, we're literally, like, every state is literally having a conversation about cutting, arguably, in the places that we need most. And by the way, in places that have already been cut, right? We're talking about decades long disinvestment in public health in this country.
Right.
Exacerbating this crisis. Right. Decades long underinvestment in education, which has led schools to be less able to respond when all their students get sent home. And so on and so forth. Like, they were already broke, and now they're breaking even more.
Yeah, and it's the least empowered and the most vulnerable among us who get the cuts. Lather, rinse, repeat. Right?
Pitchforks and torches. I'm just going to say, I read a piece. There was a piece in the New York Times where they interviewed this epidemiologist who has been like a Cassandra on all these different epidemics, and talked to her about this one. You know, she was, of course, in the cohort of like, everyone needs to take this seriously, and then they didn't. And she pointed to that. She said it was pretty dark, like her predictions of what's going to happen over the next 18 to 36 months. But one of the things she said was that we should also prepare for what she called collective rage. Because she said, you know, people are going to emerge from this and discover, I'm actually foreshadowing my news fix, so I should probably stop now. But it was, it was very interesting. Like, she basically said, as we come out of our holes and discover that, like, a lot of people upgraded their helicopters to private jets, there's going to be some reaction to that.
Speaking of the news fix, we have to take a break before we get there. Yes, let's do that. Send us an email, voice memo, what's on your mind. What's going on? Tell us how you're feeling. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. We're coming right back.
Welcome back. Boom. Actually, before, I know we said we were going to the news fix, and then I did a little news fix, but first, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, really?
Just thanks. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
That's it.
Yeah, you guys have given so much time and energy and love and email and also actual money to Make Me Smart right now, yeah. And it is like the light at the end of the tunnel, knowing that we can sit here every day and do something that clearly matters to you, and that you are telling us that in all the ways that you know how. And we are just like super grateful, because we know not everyone is in a position to donate to anything right now. And many of you have, and any amount helps. And we are super grateful.
And if you can, it's marketplace.org/give. smart, any amount, and we'll keep being able to do this. You know,
yeah.
It's a thing. Honestly, I look forward to every day. True story.
Yeah.
True story.
No, I mean, I
agree.
It's like a little bit of therapy,
yeah.
Except on the days when
you
just can't take it anymore. And yet here we are. Marketplace.org/givesmart, and then we get all the credit. All right.
What are you doing, dude?
Well,
that's what matters, URL. Getting the credit. No, I'm kidding. all right, so why don't you pick it up where you left off about what happens after, as it were.
Okay, so yes. So although I was just saying that there was, you know, she was predicting this sort of like collective rage and torches and pitchforks, what is very interesting, because obviously I've occasionally been guilty of that feeling myself, Neil Irwin, our old buddy, friend of the show.
Yeah.
Has this column talking about how what is happening in the political conversation about help is the moral hazard, the rise of the moral hazard principle and moral hazard outrage. And so that while for a moment, which is so interesting because I think it's sort of like it's following the curve of even behavior in America, right? Which was like, oh, okay, yes, we have to pull together and do whatever it takes. We got to stay home. We got to do this. And then now there's like rage and unrest and frustration. And that is also dominating the political conversation. And that increasingly, he writes, lawmakers, media coverage, and ordinary voters are focused not on preventing a potential depression, but on litigating which recipients of federal rescue are morally worthy and which are not.
Yeah.
And so he talks about how on the right, the left, the libertarians, like everything, whether it's, you know, articles about rescue money going to prep schools, we talked about the shame game on this show. So the shame game is unquestionably happening. On the other hand, conservatives are saying states and cities don't deserve help. Like, they've got to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And so you have the crashing together of these philosophies that economists point out in his piece actually are just going to slow down any help, right? They become, quote, the seeds of long, slow, painful recoveries. Because as we cannot agree, as we focus more on, and I think you've even seen this with the disbursement of existing funds, that there's been so much focus on making sure that that none of the wrong people get the money, that it's prevented the right people from getting the money. But that now, because we, and look, I mean, 2 minutes on Twitter will show you that, like, yay, outrage, and they're good stories, and they're this and that. But that ultimately it is an unfruitful path that we're on.
So there's a research paper out by the New York Fed this week pointing to the pandemic of 1918 as giving rise to the Nazi Party in Germany in the early 1930s. Just thought I'd point that out. This all has ramifications. That's my point. History matters. History matters. Know your history.
It really, really does. And that's why, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so mine is a little bit of a marker as to how long it may well be before we come out of our bunkers, as it were, and pick up the pitchforks to which Molly alluded. And I offer this just as a marker of the pace of this thing. The New York Times has come out with a newsroom memo today, and the New York Times is working remotely. They say they are not going to have everybody back in their newsroom until September the 8th. Which is a long time from now. And yes, cities and states are opening up. And yes, some companies are. And set aside for a second the second wave, and set aside for a second whatever's going to happen when all these people get together at stores and shops and you know, contact tracing doesn't work and we don't have testing. But a major American institution is saying, yeah, no, we're done until September the 8th, which I think is really interesting. I think it's really interesting. And it's a marker. And September 8th is a long time from now, man.
It's a really long time.
4 months. So it's been 2 months, and frankly, my family's cracking under the strain. I don't know how everybody else is doing. But 4 more months of this, it's going to be tricky.
Yep. Families are cracking.
Yeah.
Google and Facebook have been saying the same thing. They've both told their employees to plan to, a lot of the tech companies, have said plan to stay home through the summer.
God. All right. Let's move on.
There's no, I think this is the week where, this is the week, it started yesterday, where I at least am internalizing and beginning to seriously mourn the before times. Like, those are literally the before times, right? Like, this is...
Yeah.
I think intellectually, Yes, there was the awareness that, but as we open up, right, as we make the calculation that we have to endure both, we have to try to like move forward, and it is going to lead to more death without a doubt. And that as we move forward into what we think, we take our little baby steps into new normal. Like, it was safe to just stay home for those who could, right? Like, essential workers will be more endangered now. Like, we're entering the new normal, and I'm like, personally, waving goodbye to the old one, it's tough.
I don't know if I shared this conversation I had with Kimberly Adams with you or with somebody else, but she and I were slacking one day about reopening and blah, blah, blah. And she said, I honestly think one of the issues here and one of the reasons it's so difficult for us to move forward is we have not been able to properly mourn the before times, because they went away so fast, so quickly, that it was just like, you're done. That life is over. Yep. Move on. And that's not the way human beings work, man. You know?
Right.
You can't just shut it down. And I think that's a real thing.
I think it is. And I think we're going to feel it more and more as we start to like creep forward and realize just how different it really is.
Yep.
Without a doubt. Yep. All right. Let you talk for a minute.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right. Last week, we asked people living in states that are reopening to tell us what that is like. Our first comment comes from Joe Beth in Oklahoma City, where businesses are starting to open up. City officials actually had to back down last weekend on their mandate that people wear masks in public because of criticism and threats of violence. There was actual violence in Michigan over this this week. Mm-hmm. Here's Joe Beth.
I was killed.
One more. I mean, I say actual violence, and what I mean is a woman shot a security guard in the head because he asked her to wear a mask. Like, talk about the end of the before times. Anyway, here's Jo Beth on what's happening there.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Jo Beth in Oklahoma City. Our governor has decided we're going back at it, and I'm on the city council in Oklahoma City, and mayors across the state have either stepped in line or provided a little bit of extra requirements or guidelines as we're doing in Oklahoma City, but many of us are still not satisfied that that's going to be able to keep people safe. There's a task force at the state level that met this week, and the Secretary of Commerce had a series of questions essentially advocating for the federal unemployment relief to go away because people were making too much money on unemployment, and that businesses that are trying to reopen aren't going to be able to coax people back into work because they don't pay them enough. It just reminded me of that capitalism really doesn't care if you live or die. They just want workers and don't actually want to offer competitive wages. Yeah, it just really reminded me that we don't have the infrastructure that we need as a country, as a state, or as in our cities to really give people true options when it comes to how to respond to COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fear. Like, I think that honestly is a little bit of what I was feeling yesterday when the, you know, news came out that California is thinking about stair-stepping to opening. And it was this combination of the knowledge that, like, we're not ready, right? Even just referring to test, trace, and isolate, like I was talking about yesterday. We're not ready to do that, but we have to. But also, we're all seized with the, like, deep, profound, fundamental desire to try to go back to normal. And it's just, like, not. Yeah. It's going to be tough.
All right. So Tennessee is where we go. Jim Clark, he says this: I'm writing to you still at home with my whole family, wife, brother, sister, and her fiance, mom, and dad. The state is beginning to reopen with the governor ending the shelter-in-place order and restaurants already operating at 50% capacity. Editorial comment here. Wow. As is so often the case, we hear mostly from the extremes, Jim writes. Angry people on the right criticizing the government, thinking they're losing their liberties. Angry people on the left criticizing the government that the quarantine is ending too soon. It all makes me so sad. I don't think most Tennesseans fall in either of these extremities. Most, I hope, understand the need for distance and want to get back to work. In so many ways, he goes on, this virus is truly the American kryptonite. In a country that has institutionalized individualism, we're suddenly faced with a power that forces us to reckon with just how connected we really are. If there are any other Tennesseans listening, I'd say that we can do this well. Keep supporting our local businesses. Keep ordering takeout and delivery from restaurants. If you can't sit down, maintain the spirit of generosity and care for others that has gotten us this far. Wear masks in public. I promise it'll get less weird. Love from Tennessee. He closes, Jim.
Oh, bless him. That was wonderful. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. One thing about this that is obviously impossible to ignore, we just talked about it and talk about it, I think, every day, is the emotional toll. Like Jim said, people have extreme, you have these extremely impassioned people on both sides. It is small numbers. But ultimately, it isn't politics. It is literally life or death for some people. Here's listener Don Burley Hill wrestling with the question of how you navigate conversations like we are all having with people who don't agree with you about what's happening with this pandemic.
Hi, Make Me Smart. This is Dawn Burley Hill in Yucaipa. I am trying to navigate some difficult conversations with people I love, some of whom think that it would be okay to just open up the economy tomorrow and it's fine if, you know, some percentage of people are just going to die. Oh, and by the way, they had pre-existing conditions, so they deserved it. I don't know if this is just the natural extension of the kinds of conversations that people have been having in the Trump presidency era, but it's a frightening thing to have your friend say to you, especially when you're in one of those risk groups. So anyway, guys, if you can make me smart about any of that, how to have that conversation better, that would be great. Thank you guys for the show. I really have loved listening every day.
So me, look, mm-hmm. I'm not trying to be flip here at all. I just avoid those conversations. It's just nod and smile,
really?
And say, look, okay, fine, whatever. Yeah, you know. Times are tough enough. Times are tough enough. That's what I
mean. I hear you. Yep, I hear you. I have I wish I were.
Yeah.
I could not be more different.
Right. Whew.
But I will say, frankly, it is like you almost have to, right? I've been attempting to be like more Buddhist about it, like desire is the root of all pain.
Mm-hmm.
It is not. We will see. History is long. I will do my best to keep myself and those I love safe. And like, there is no, if there's anything we have learned, then it's not even just in the Trump presidency, right? Like, we're reaping the seeds of divisions in this country that were sown in the early 90s. And I'm just talking about this exact era and even before. It wouldn't be less divisive under a different president. Like, it just wouldn't. And so nobody's changing any minds right now. Just stay safe.
So we close, as we always do, with a Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about? It's kind of a response to Dawn's question about how to deal with those difficult conversations. Here's Allison Miravari.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Allison in Seattle. Something I thought I knew that I later found out I was wrong about was that challenging emotions are a bad thing and something that we should try to get rid of. For most of my life, I tried to talk myself out of hard feelings I was having. I would try to problem solve away whatever was upsetting. But none of this really helped and usually just made me feel worse. Eventually, though, through many years of practice and guidance, I learned that the best thing we can do with challenging feelings is actually to just let ourselves feel them. And that by allowing hard feelings to be present, they actually feel more tolerable, especially as time goes on. In our new pandemic world, there are a lot of tough feelings. Many of us feel sad or scared or overwhelmed. And while these feelings have been really challenging, letting myself feel them rather than fight them has helped. And sometimes that's all that we can do.
Yeah, I mean, you got to feel the feels, right? That's the thing. And you can't make value judgments about anybody else feeling the feels, because I've had them at the beginning of this thing a lot. You know, so it's just, it's all
it
real.
It turns out, as with real. So many things, Kimberly Adams was really right. So, yes, that's great advice. Right. And that's all we got. That is it for the show today. Sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter. marketplace.org/newsletters. You can email us. Just email us, like, tell us how you're feeling. You guys are great at that. Thank you. And, you know, But I mean, really, like, it's a weird, we got a little weird symbiotic thing happening here.
Yeah.
So thanks. Thanks for like being there for us and also listening. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Here we go. What do you want to know Wednesday? It's tomorrow, right? Tomorrow's Wednesday.
Oh my God. Tomorrow's Wednesday?
Yes.
What do you want to know Wednesday?
Wednesday. There you go.
All right. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, our video intern, Ethan Peretz, and writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
Drew Jostad engineered the program today. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And there you go. There you go. Another one in the can.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.